We had some concerns. I mean, it just got worse and worse. There were actual shots fired.
Boys who thought that they were girls going into the girls' bathroom made me uncomfortable.
I ended up putting my arm around her and praying out loud the first day in the public school.
The United States is in the midst of a public school exodus. In the past 5 years, enrollment across the nation has declined by almost 2 million students. So where are they all going? Well, some are moving to private education, especially since parental choice programs continue to expand. Right now, there are 29 states that offer some kind of school choice funding, and 12 more states are currently considering similar programs. But what might really surprise you is that the fastest growing schooling in America is out of the classroom and into the home. That's right, homeschooling. In 2019, there were 2.5 million homeschool students. Today, it's more than 4 million and it's rising. So what are the main motivations of Christian families who decide to opt out of public school? And what are they choosing as an alternative? The answers might surprise you. I'm Jennifer Lassick, and you're listening to the podcast Grace Ed. We'll be discussing these topics and more on today's episode, Exploring the Exodus, Why Christian Families Are Choosing Alternatives to Public Education. Stay tuned. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the pilot episode of the Grace Ed podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be bringing you a variety of relevant and timely topics centered around Christian education in all its forms, whether in brick and mortar, virtual, or homeschools across many platforms, curriculums, and methodologies. We'll address social and political issues that affect Christian educators, and we'll encourage you with inspiring stories, helpful resources, and of course, wisdom rooted in biblical principles from God's Word. Those of us who have labored in Christian education know its value, but since the COVID-19 pandemic first started making its way across the globe, there's been a public school departure that has continued right up to the present. The public school system in the United States is failing. We're the richest nation in the world, but our students are currently ranked 30th globally in mathematics. 1 in 3 fourth graders in the U.S. cannot read at a basic level. That means they're essentially non-readers. And among our Black and Brown communities, it's 1 in every 2. In the United States, we have the highest paid but worst educated workers in the entire world. So today, for our very first episode, we want to explore some of the reasons why Christian families are opting out of the public school system. You'll hear stories from Christian moms who are trying to navigate their children's educational journeys. And you'll hear my own difficult story as a mother, which in large part guides my passion about Christian education in all its forms. I've spent a lot of time reading articles and researching the decline in public school enrollment. The numbers are significant. Since 2019, public schools have lost 4 to 5% of their students nationally. Again, that's about 2 million students. Most of the article suggests that parents choose to put their children in private education or choose to homeschool because of a variety of failures on the part of public schools. Parents might opt out because the school can't accommodate their child's individual learning style, or because the pace is too fast or too slow for their children. Some parents have special needs children and feel the school is not meeting those needs. Other parents seem to be leaving in order to escape something that they perceive as dangerous for their children. Things like school violence, being the victim of bullies, the LGBTQ+ agenda, liberal curriculum, negative peer pressure. These are all things Christian parents might want to get their kids away from. And of course, some parents choose an alternative education plan because of the positive benefit it offers, regardless of whether their area schools are good or bad. We interviewed Sarah, a mom who made schooling decisions for her children based on wanting them to have the very best experiences and opportunities possible. Sarah fascinated us because of how her own journey became her foundation as a mom. Her story isn't about running away from bad experiences or failure. Instead, it's about moving toward the best options and lifestyle for herself and her family. Sarah and her husband Joe have 3 children, Olivia, age 18, she's in her first year of college, Wesley, who's 16 and a high school junior, and Levi, age 13, he's in 7th grade. When Sarah was growing up, she was homeschooled through most of elementary and middle school, and she loved it. Here's Sarah talking about her experience.
So my parents started with me in private school. We had a school connected with our church, and I went kindergarten and part of first grade, but then the cost, which wasn't expensive, was too much for our young family, and my mom brought me home in first grade. And I don't have any memory wishing I was at school. I was perfectly happy.
There's a lot of controversy in our country about the validity as well as the quality of homeschooling. Studies show that children who are homeschooled tend to score 15 to 20% higher on standardized tests than public school students. But some argue that only the more rigorous and capable homeschool students even take the tests, so the scores don't really reflect the entire homeschool population. In public schools, the testing is required of all students regardless of their achievement, capacity, or attendance at school, which tends to lower the overall average scores. And that's true. In fact, there are many homeschool families who don't do any kind of testing, but instead rely on other forms of assessments. They might use content-based projects, verbal presentations, or writing assignments as just a few examples. But homeschool students typically score above average on the SAT and ACT tests as well. Now that's a comparison between college-bound homeschool students and college-bound public school students, so it's more of an apples-to-apples comparison, and homeschoolers still come out on top. My own personal opinion about the quality of homeschooling is that it depends. It depends on a lot of factors, and the biggest one is probably the attitude and commitment of the parents. I worked at a private Christian school where one of my roles was to be the liaison for families who were enrolling their children after they'd been homeschooling them for a time. And what I will say is this, I've seen homeschooling done really, really well, but I've also seen my share of train wrecks. Sarah's mom was a great example of the model homeschooling parent. She was a very young mom and didn't have a college degree, but she'd been an honor student herself. She loved learning. She was organized and disciplined, and she took the responsibility very seriously.
In the beginning of the year, my mom would go through all of our curriculum and determine what it would take for us to finish the book. Such an interesting perspective, because when I went to brick and mortar school in ninth grade, I was so shocked that they didn't finish the book. We finished all the books, and I really didn't know that schools didn't. I remember looking at my book and thinking, we only have like a month left of school. How are we going to do all of this? And so then we had one lesson in math, you know, history lessons we needed to do a couple times a week, science a couple times a week, you know, do a chapter in spelling every week, that sort of thing. And a couple pages of English, or when we got older, it was 4 pages of English, which just seemed like a terrible chore. We scarcely ever had to do any schoolwork after lunchtime.
Sarah's comment about the schedule tracks. Other families who homeschool have said the same thing. When students are learning at home without the distractions and interruptions, you know, other students having to wait for everyone to use the bathroom, the teacher having to deal with discipline problems, or when they have to take time to help struggling students, it takes a lot less time to get the daily instruction and practice done. I saw a Reddit thread that asked homeschoolers their reason for doing so, and in the interest of full disclosure, it was definitely not a Christian-friendly or religion-friendly group, so values and religious instruction didn't come up much. But having a flexible schedule and being able to move through the curriculum at their child's individual learning pace, those were two of the most cited reasons. Okay, they were done by noon most days, so that brought my question, how did they fill their afternoons?
We were taking piano lessons, and we were just flying through our piano books because we had time to practice. I remember doing a lot of different crafting things or spending a lot of time outside year-round, doing things with my siblings. We had a Monopoly game going in my big walk-in closet in our bedroom for days and days because we could.
In the interview, I offhandedly referred to the afternoons as free time. My initial perspective was that once school was over at noon, the day became recreational. But Sarah took me to task on my conventional thoughts about what constitutes instruction or what I deemed learning activities.
Education is not only the bookwork. Education is cooking, learning responsibility. When you get older, learning different skills or trades. When you're younger, learning self-responsibility, learning homemaking. Even if you want to look into making a recipe and using it for math, we're going to double this recipe, so we need to double all of these fractional measurements and so on and so forth. As a culture, we look at education as, oh, you're sitting at the table doing bookwork, but that is such a part only.
Sarah's right, of course. The family continued homeschooling until she was in high school, when her parents enrolled Sarah and eventually all their children in a private Christian school. At first, Sarah was nervous about it, wondering if her homeschool education had served her well. But her worries turned out to be unfounded. Her academics were strong, and she loved the social aspect of school. She also mentioned how important it was to have other Christian adults speaking into her life. She graduated and went on to earn a 4-year degree in teaching. Sarah had a chance to work at a public school during her practicum, and she described the culture as very different from what she'd seen and experienced in a private school setting. The word she used was chaotic. Children were constantly getting out of their seats and interrupting the teachers, and mind you, this was pre-COVID era. It seemed that students were exiting and entering the classroom endlessly to use the bathrooms or to get water. The teachers spent a lot of time dealing with behavioral issues and had to take a lot of time to help students who were struggling. Not much learning was happening, she concluded, and she found it discouraging. Eventually, Sarah ended up teaching at the very school where she had graduated, and she taught right up until her first child, Olivia, was born. Even though she had enjoyed attending school in person and had loved teaching in her classroom, Sarah knew from the very beginning of being a mom that she wanted to homeschool.
I had such fond memories of being home as a child. I must have known homeschooling was the flexibility and the learning-rich environment that I was looking for my children and our family. My husband and I own a small business, and homeschooling seemed to fit so well into that. By the time that my oldest was starting kindergarten, we had had our third child who ended up having cerebral palsy. So we had that aspect as well, where I was going to be called upon to support my youngest child. I really think I always knew that that's what I was going to do. I'm thinking through it now, though, and I'm surprised because I didn't know very much compared to, after years of experience, the things that I learned along the way. I'm surprised that I knew enough then. That's what I mean.
Having a special needs child and making sure those needs are met to their highest potential requires the parents to be both brave and fierce. Sarah is a lioness. In Milwaukee County, it's really easy to get services for children from ages birth to 3. But once Levi reached school age, services were provided through the local schools in an IEP. IEP stands for Individualized Education Plan. It's created by having a team of teachers, administrators, counselors, and healthcare professionals document a child's special needs. Then they create a learning plan that lists the accommodations, therapies, and services that the child will get through the school. But that meant Levi would have to attend school in order to get his therapies because the state doesn't allow partial services. It was all or nothing. At the time, the family was living in Milwaukee, and Milwaukee public schools were notoriously bad in culture, safety, and achievement. Sarah and her husband Joe had a lot of concerns, in no small part because Levi is mostly nonverbal, which means he wouldn't have been able to use the words to tell his parents anything that happened during the day. And to give you an idea of the situation at MPS, their 22-23 district report card shows an overall mathematics score of 23% out of 100. That's less than half the state average. And an English language arts score of 32%, which is barely half the statewide average. Their graduation rate is under 70%, and in the 21-22 school year, MPS placed 1,310 calls to the police for incidents taking place on their campuses. It was a non sequitur. Levi stayed home, and Sarah worked with him as best she could as they homeschooled their two older children. But soon after that, Sarah and Joe were able to realize their dream of moving the family to a rural area outside the city. Joe suggested putting Levi in the community's elementary school so he could receive services, but Sarah fretted about his care. They went back and forth until Sarah got some advice from a friend.
I felt like after my years of experience, I was such a homeschool purist and couldn't imagine sending my youngest child He's nonverbal primarily and a lot of other complications, and I couldn't imagine even putting him in. I spent time talking with my husband about it, and the first thing he said in the conversation was, just put him in, just try it. And I said, Joe, what if he doesn't drink his water? He could have another seizure. What if he does this or what if he does that? He's not able to tell us if people are mean to him. And I just went on and on for like 30 minutes. And at the end of the conversation, poor Joe said, well, you just do what you think is best. And he has deferred to me over the years based on my experience. So it was the Sunday before Levi's official IEP meeting at our little rural school. And I was asking a friend for prayer and just said, it's coming up. Would you just pray? And I said, my husband said, Sarah, how much can you do? And she stopped me. And she said, Sarah, you could submit to your husband. And I felt the Lord change my heart. I believe in the word, and I believe God has clearly defined roles for healthy marriage relationships. It spoke to me.
Sarah says that the experience with the public school in her rural community has been largely positive. Levi is happy, and he's receiving the accommodations and therapies that he needs. Sarah, for her part, is very present in both his classroom and in the district, volunteering and making sure she's informed and involved. She gives this advice to parents, whether they homeschool or enroll their children in a brick-and-mortar school.
For public school, be involved. Be in your child's classroom. Get involved in the school board if you're able. Be on the PTO so that you know what's happening in your child's school and in their classroom and in their homework and all that stuff. And a second level, show the love of Jesus in that school to those teachers. Smile, give gifts, support. Do everything you can to be a light. It works. For private school families, I would suggest don't sit back on your laurels and think that just because your kid's in a private school or a Christian school that everything's fine. I would say the same thing, be involved, be there. And also, typically, Christian schools need more support. They're running on tighter budgets. Pour into them if you can. It's a short time frame where you've got your kids in school, comparatively, right? For homeschooled families, I would say, don't worry so much about looking like a school. You have the, I have to say, privilege, being able to homeschool your children. Don't waste it by trying to have rigorous schedules, or rigid, I should say, schedules, or all of this priority of always doing the bookwork. Homeschooling is, one of the beauties of it is flexibility. Look at what your children need. Serve them.
But not all parents who have a child with special needs find the same positive experience as Sarah and Levi did. In fact, the National Center for Educational Statistics asked parents why they opted out of public schools, and there was a pretty significant percentage of families who said it was because they had a child whose special needs were not being met. I think that's pretty astounding considering the amount of money that's spent on special needs programming in public schools. Kara is a mom who lives in a small Midwestern town. That's not her real name. Due to the size of their community and her family's prominence in it, we wanted to protect her privacy. Kara's son, who I'll call Henry, was diagnosed at a young age with ADHD and generalized anxiety disorder. Kara tried for years to work with the public school staff and administration to get her son's needs met. In elementary school, she found her son's ability to thrive depended largely upon the attitude and experience of whichever teacher he had that year. In the hands of an experienced and empathetic first grade teacher, Henry was successful. But in second grade, he had a first year teacher who seemed at a loss in accommodating his needs, and it affected his academic progress and his emotional health. Then as Henry moved through the school, it became apparent that teachers compared notes and shared student information in a way that Kara felt painted a target on Henry's back regarding his behavior. In short, he didn't have the chance to start fresh each fall. In middle school, the class structure changed from mostly self-contained classrooms to a system where the students rotated from teacher to teacher and room to room. The inconsistency and stress had a negative effect on Henry's behavior as well as his relationship with his peers, which Kara said could already be strained due to Henry's anxiety in social situations and his ADHD. Henry began to suffer at the hands of class bullies. When he got tired of it and started to stand up for himself, a group of boys physically attacked him once in the fall of 2021 and again in February of 2022. The second time, they waited for him to arrive at school and then beat him severely enough in front of school staff that he needed medical attention for a concussion. Then those same students subjected him to cyberbullying by posting the attack on TikTok to music. It was up for 3 days before TikTok removed it, after it had already been shared thousands of times. That wasn't the end. The boys continued to taunt Henry, sending more than 300 threatening text messages, to which Henry's only response was, "Just leave me alone." Then the boys started sending Kara text messages as well, threatening Henry and questioning her parenting. Yeah, you heard that right. They were brazen enough to taunt an adult. They even stalked her while she was picking her kids up from school, sending her messages that said, "I see you," with side-eye emojis. Kara showed me some of the texts. Most of them can't be shared with you because the language is so graphic and so vulgar. But to give you an idea, here's one text to Henry. And by the way, where I read a letter, the whole expletive is actually written out in the text. "Don't go telling all them teachers, and if you run away like a little bee, then I'll chase after you, throw you down the stairs, stomp on your effing head, give you multiple cheap shots until you can't effing talk anymore, and that's when I'll be effing done with you. You understand?" Now, you may be wondering why Kara didn't go to the police at this point. Well, she did. She shared the police report with me. And in the end, not one arrest was made. Not one citation was given. There was no real investigation in that small town. In fact, to Kara's knowledge, the police only ever talked to one of the extended family members of the kids who assaulted Henry. The only consequence they ever received was a school suspension. Kara told me that on the very day the boys returned from their suspensions, one of the same group of kids took a big swig of water and then spit it out in Henry's face. But this time, Henry pushed the kid, a fight ensued, they fell to the floor, Henry climbed on top of him and began to punch the other kid repeatedly. Kara said it was like all the pent-up emotion just came spilling out at once. This time, Henry was suspended for 5 days. There were other things, too. The rules just seemed different for Henry than other students. For example, there was one time when Henry got in trouble for wearing a baseball cap at school, at the same time that a couple of girls who identified as cats, they were referred to as furries, were allowed to be in classes in full cat costumes complete with leashes. Henry found that patently unfair. Kara continued to try to partner with the school. She even offered to buy a book for each staff member that focused on collaborative and proactive solutions to helping students with behavioral challenges. She got no response to that. In fact, eventually the administration simply stopped responding to Kara altogether. The trauma was causing a spiral for Henry and for their family. During this same time, Henry's younger sister was also in the school, but she was having a very different experience. Kara was extremely honest in her assessment. "My daughter is a rule follower, gets along well with other kids, and is considered one of the good kids." Kara also observed that Henry's class had a different culture in general because there were more boys than girls, and they had bigger personalities that seemed to bring a higher tendency for aggressive behavior. When they had exhausted every avenue of finding a way for Henry to navigate the academic and social barriers without jeopardizing his mental and physical well-being, Kara and her husband made the decision to pull Henry out and to homeschool him. I've observed that sometimes when parents make the decision to homeschool based on emotion or trauma, they then struggle with it in terms of the rigor, the structure, and the content. Not so with Kara. She said that with Henry's needs, it works best for them to do a school-at-home model. So they're up early, and they begin their schoolwork by 8:30 a.m. Kara uses a mix of curriculum with video instruction and assessments. When Henry's done with his schoolwork for the day, he's allowed to manage his free time as long as it's not screen time. He loves to be outdoors. He enjoys building electronics, and he's even entrepreneurial, earning money by recycling copper. Kara says he's really beginning to thrive. In all of this, I was curious about the role of their family's faith. Kara and her family are Christians and they attend church. But Kara says what happened and the decisions her family made really didn't take religious instruction or their values into consideration. "That wasn't it," she said. "We were just completely in survival mode. If we hadn't have pulled him out, I don't think he'd be alive today." She said his anxiety and self-esteem were so damaged by that time, she honestly believes he would have taken his own life. Of course, the bullying and cruelty that seems to be increasing in our schools doesn't happen in a bubble. Our schools in many ways are a reflection of the lack of empathy and humanity that we're seeing throughout our communities and our society right now. And it's not rocket science. The more our leaders and citizens reject God and reject the love of Christ, the less people are going to treat one another with dignity and kindness. And then there's my story about my own daughter. I never told this to anyone before preparing for this first episode of the podcast, but as we were listening to other family stories, I found myself recounting our journey to Tara, and she was adamant that it needed to be shared. I'm not going to lie, it's not a shining testimony. It's more like a cautionary tale of what not to do as a Christian parent trying to raise a child in the faith. My daughter attended a private Christian school for her first 7 years, and then a public school in a small, primarily Mormon community, and then finally a large, very liberal public high school in a busy cosmopolitan city. In other words, we went from one end of the spectrum all the way to the other. When Aislinn was born, we were attending my grandfather's church, and my husband and I were both working at the school that he and my grandmother founded. The church had a daycare, so while I worked, Aislinn was right across the parking lot, and I could walk over and nurse her and hold her in between my classes. I was teaching high school, and my students adored her. They always wanted to hold her and carry her around, and she stayed in the daycare right up until she was old enough to go into K-4. Our whole lives were wrapped up around the church and the school. Aislinn was one of those children who slept under the pew during long evening services and played hide-and-seek in the corridors with her cousins. Her grandparents, aunts, and uncles and cousins were all members of the church. We worshiped together and prayed together and socialized together. She'd never even been babysat by anyone outside of my extended family. And since my grandfather was the pastor and founder of the church, she was known and loved by everybody there. Here's Aislinn, now 23, describing what she remembers about her grandparents' school in Wisconsin.
I remember being in K-4, and at nap time, Sister Gazetta, my K-4 teacher, would always rub our backs and sing to us, and she just seemed to really care about the kids. I remember after school going to hang out with you and Dad in your classrooms in the high school. I remember the uniforms. I remember feeling really close to all of my teachers. I always felt like they're here to make sure that I feel good and I'm happy.
When Aislinn was almost 3, I started my master's degree. And by the time she was 7, I'd completed it, and I was beginning to look for work in my new field of public administration and nonprofit management. I found a fantastic career opportunity out in Wyoming in a city that was constructing a brand new cultural arts and events center. They were looking for its first director, and they offered me the job. My husband, who worked in IT, encouraged me to take the position because he knew he could work from anywhere in the country. So we made the decision to move 1,300 miles away from our family and church. I loved it from the moment we got there, although it was like being in a different world. Adam and I had lived in France for a short time when we were first married, and I tell people we had less culture shock moving there than we did when we moved to Wyoming, and that's totally true. There were less than 4,000 people in the town in Wyoming, but they had more than 110,000 antelope. Most people were either ranchers or they worked for the oil or gas companies. Cowboys walked around town in their cowboy hats, wearing chaps over their jeans with spurs on their cowboy boots. Everyone had a gun in a holster, another in the glove box, and usually one or two rifles mounted on their enormous pickup trucks. At the Cultural Arts and Events Center, the sheetrock had only just been hung, so I jumped in, working with the architects and contractors to get the building finished. And then it was my job to finish and appoint it, establish policies, raise money for the endowment, and start getting bookings and events. One of my very first projects was to host a huge opening gala with the governor as the keynote speaker. It was so exciting. I couldn't shower fast enough to get to work. But what I didn't give nearly enough thought to was how the move would affect Aislinn, or what it would be like to be truly isolated from both our extended family and our church family. The realization that we were truly all alone hit me like a ton of bricks on one particular morning. I was in my new office in City Hall, and I was filling out enrollment forms for Aislinn to enter the second grade in the middle of the semester. The third page of the form asked for the name and phone number of an emergency contact. I stared at it for a long time, and then I finally came out of my office. The deputy clerk was sitting at her desk, and I knew she was also a mom. I cleared my throat, and when she looked up, I asked, "Would you possibly be willing to be the emergency contact for my daughter at school?" She said, "Of course." And after a pause, I was like, "What's your last name?" I wrote down the information and then went back in my office and closed the door and just broke down crying. It was the first time Aislinn would ever experience being an outsider.
It was different. It was scary. I remember the first few days were very quiet. I spent a lot of time by myself. They were very country. Almost everyone had a horse. Everyone lived in big ranches with huge backyards. Everyone wore bootcut jeans with cowboy boots underneath. And I remember not getting to hang out with my friends all that much outside of school. Their parents didn't like that I wasn't Mormon. I had a teacher in fourth grade and then again in sixth grade who, for whatever reason, didn't seem to like me very much. And I remember feeling very targeted almost. Like, nothing I ever did was good enough. I was always the bad kid in class. I was always the one getting yelled at or sent out of the room. My teachers in Wisconsin were basically family. It was always, "I love you so much. You're so loved. Welcome to class. I'm so happy to see you today." And I remember getting that interaction. And then when I went to Wyoming, it was very, almost at an arm's length.
There was a joke that in our new town, 50% were Mormon, 30% were Catholic, and then there were all the rest of the heathen. That was in reference to the spattering of tiny congregations that made up all the other denominations. None of those churches were anything like our church in Wisconsin. For one thing, there wasn't any contemporary worship. For another, the congregations were tiny and tended to have few, if any, young people in them. The church we eventually chose to attend had a total of 7 kids from ages 5 through 16, and the only kids who were within 3 years of Aislinn's age on either side were boys. My friend Mark was the Methodist pastor. He was on my board, and he and his wife Doris had become close to our family. After we'd been there for about a year and a half, he started having contemporary worship services on the last week of months that had 5 Sundays. He invited us to come knowing that we came from an evangelical background. So one morning, we attended and we were standing in the congregation and they were playing a worship track and the song was "How Great Is Our God." I was thrilled to be worshiping to a song we actually knew, but it wasn't going over very well with the Methodists. Halfway through the song, I glanced down at my daughter and I saw that she was crying. I bent down and asked her if she was okay. She nodded. I paused and then asked, "Aislinn, are you feeling Jesus?" She nodded, tears falling down her cheeks. I looked at the people around us. Most of them were sitting with their arms crossed in front of their chests, lips pursed in disapproval. And those who were standing, like we were, stood stiffly at attention. Many of them seemed to just be mouthing the words while their hands white-knuckled the pews in front of them. I looked at my daughter again and hesitated. I didn't want to miss an opportunity with her. So I whispered to my husband, "I think Aislinn's feeling the spirit. I'm going to take her out." He looked over and nodded. I took my daughter's hand and we exited out a side door into a small fellowship room. I knelt in front of her and I helped her to raise her arms. And in that little room, we prayed and wept and talked to Jesus. Afterward, I hugged her tightly. It was the most beautiful experience. But later came the realization that it was the one and only moment like that in Wyoming. Our worship, which was once joyful and rich and passionate, was becoming as muted as the washed-out tones of the rocks and sagebrush around us. We were there 5 years, and Aislinn adjusted and made friends and grew to love the wilderness of Wyoming as well as all of our family time together and our travels throughout the area. But those 5 years were marked by the deaths of loved ones too, and missing time with them before they passed away was yet another price we paid for being so far away from family. In those 5 years, my great-grandmother, my grandmother, my mother, Adam's mother, and a dear friend all passed away. Then in 2013, my sister had her first baby after my mom had died, and I wanted to be able to help her with my new niece. I didn't want to be that auntie way out there in Wyoming. My original boss had left the city administrator position for a job with Chevron, and the person who replaced him brought a chaotic, uneasy culture to the city. It was time to return to the Midwest. I found a cultural arts job in Evanston, Illinois, a suburb on Chicago's North Shore where Northwestern University is located. Evanston is a city with its own proper downtown and lots of public transportation. It's a shopping and foodie haven, and it has beautiful neighborhoods where trees canopy the streets. It runs along the shoreline of Lake Michigan, and best of all, it was an easy drive up 94 to get to Milwaukee, where most of my family lived. Adam and I told Aislinn we were moving, and I honestly was not prepared for how upset she was. To me, we were going home, and it was wonderful. I mean, Wyoming was fine, but it wasn't like we ever thought we'd retire there, live out our lives, and be buried in the high desert. I hadn't thought about the fact that Wyoming had become Aislinn's primary childhood experience at the age when she could remember her experiences and where her friendships had become deep. She was devastated by the move. To make things worse, Wyoming really was the wild, wild west. It was nature, nature everywhere. Mountains, stars that twinkled all the way down to the horizon. Living in Wyoming was seeing the Milky Way with the naked eye, and Wyoming was quiet and incredibly safe. In fact, it was so safe that our regular practice in the winter was to leave our car running in the parking lot of the grocery store while we shopped so that the car would be warm when we came out of the store. Never once did we worry about the car being stolen while we were inside. Evanston was crowded and bustling, and crime was a factor. Tall buildings obscured the view, and the traffic, oh my goodness, the Chicago traffic. In Wyoming, it wasn't unusual to travel from one town to another and not see one building, one car, or one person in between. In Evanston, a 5-mile drive took 30 minutes or more because of all the cars and the traffic and the stoplights. There were less than 4,000 people in our little town in Wyoming. Aislinn's high school in Evanston would have more than 4,000 students, with huge diversity in race, religion, and culture. In Wyoming, there had been occasional school lockdowns because a mountain lion had been spotted in the area. In Evanston, there were lockdowns because of gang shootings in the neighborhood where the school was located. And where Wyoming had been very conservative politically and socially, Evanston is pretty much the Berkeley of the Midwest. In other words, it's about as liberal as it gets. And not for nothing, but you don't have to live in an uber-liberal city to find your child's public school permeated by liberal ideology. Jonah Davids, a fellow at the Maine Institute, recently wrote an article entitled "The American Classroom is More Broken Than You Think." In it, he notes that 80% of recent high school graduates report being taught critical race theory concepts in school, such as "America is a systemically racist society" and "White people have unconscious bias that negatively affects non-white people." And a Brookings study of more than 5,000 public elementary and middle schools and over 1,200 public high schools found that LGBTQ+ books or materials were in 96% of the high schools and 78% of the elementary and middle schools. Now, when I asked Aislinn about the ways the culture was more liberal in Evanston, Illinois than Kemmer, Wyoming, she was quick to list the typical urban school things: school lockdowns, student fights, the drugs. But in part, this was because she didn't really want to talk about some of the things we faced as a family during our time there.
Being in Evanston was a lot more socially liberal, socially left-leaning. I remember the LGBT community there was enormous. All of my friends in high school were going to pride parades and women's parades. And we did a lot of readings and things that were about same-sex couples. Or I remember reading a poem about a woman who transitioned from man to male to female. And I remember getting in a lot of arguments with you and Dad because I started to take those ideas as my own. And it just, I think, broke your guys' heart a little bit to hear me talk like that after growing up in the church. And like, as someone who knew the Bible and has been raised on the Bible teachings.
I asked her if she felt comfortable talking about the events that took place and her own inner battles. And she didn't feel she was ready to do that. She also asked me not to go into detail, but she did give me permission to give you all a broad view.
I played chameleon a lot. When I was with my friends, I said all the right things. I supported being gay. I told them that I was a liberal. I told them that I hated Donald Trump and that I don't go to church. And I just would lie. I played chameleon. And when I was with my extended family, I did the opposite. I was all about church. And I was excited that Trump was elected. And I couldn't believe that some people really could like someone of the same sex. And I didn't know what I believed. I didn't have any firm standing, but I remember flip-flopping a lot.
Here's what I can share with you. Not only was Aislinn innocent when we first arrived in Evanston, but so were Adam and I as parents. Things had changed drastically since we went through public school, and up until that point, we'd been sheltered in the Christian school in Milwaukee and in the Mormon community in Wyoming. And when we got to Illinois, we were able to reconnect with our church family, and Aislinn was able to join a very strong youth group. Problem solved. I thought we would just pick up where we left off, no harm, no foul. I had a lot to learn, and man, did I learn a lot of things in Evanston. For example, I learned that there are websites that promote anorexia and teach girls in detail how to hate their bodies that God created and how to starve themselves. I learned that there are threads on TikTok and Reddit where adolescents take pictures and videos of themselves cutting their skin and harming themselves, and then they share them with others who do the same, where it becomes a kind of competition to see who can withstand the worst injuries. I learned that cyberbullying is real, and that middle schoolers are way more knowledgeable about sexually graphic and deviantly violent things than they ever should be, and it only gets worse when they get into high school. I learned that there are more online predators than there are grains of sand on Lake Michigan's shore, and that lonely, isolated girls and boys are prime targets for those predators. And I learned that even children who grow up in the closest relationships with their parents can hide deep, dangerous secrets. I learned all of this in real time as we were desperately trying to navigate all the things finding the way into our home and into my daughter's mind and heart and what I thought was our safe Christian bubble. I was very present when we were in the thick of it, trying to salvage our sweet child and untangle the deep web of lies the enemy was feeding her. But if you want to know where I was when they first started getting a foothold, the answer is, I was working with city officials and council members and artists and residents, pouring myself into the community. Sure, I was at every parent-teacher conference and every concert and every water polo match. I made sure my daughter got to youth group. But I was gone a lot of afternoons when my daughter was left to her own devices. And I was gone a lot of evenings when spontaneous but important conversations could have been taking place. When it came to her spiritual and emotional health, I was often playing catch-up rather than being on the offensive. I was reactive rather than intentional. The hard truth that I've had to look in the mirror and face is that without intending to, without consciously thinking about it, I sacrificed my daughter on the altar of my career. Wow, that's really hard to even say out loud. And I know that the things that I just mentioned are terrifying for any parent to hear. But even worse was the effect that the constant barrage of liberal ideology had on Aislinn. We could feel her drifting away from us and from her roots, and she felt it too. It didn't seem like any conversations were having the impact on her that we needed them to have. We almost lost her. We probably should have. God was so merciful to us. You know, it was the pandemic. For all the terrible things that happened because of COVID-19, I will forever be grateful that the shutdowns brought Aislinn home from college and that the time that we were sheltering in place was a time of healing and growing close again and a rebirth in Aislinn's faith. It's a miracle that my daughter's faith is intact and she's a believer. She's getting married in January and she and her fiance attend church with us. They'll raise their children in the church. She loves music, and I'm always getting new inspirational worship songs off her playlist. I don't know why God spared us. Maybe it was because of his covenant with my grandparents, who served him faithfully in the ministry until the day each of them passed. Maybe it's because I overcame all odds myself to remain a disciple from the time I was 12 years old. Maybe it's because I have a fierce, loyal, faith-filled prayer warrior friend, Sharon, who's prayed over my family and I since we met. But there are many parents who could say the exact same things, whose children have left their faith and not found their way back. I don't know the answer, but I do know this. Our children are the most precious thing over which God gives us stewardship, and they're also the most vulnerable. And we can't trust the public education system with them. Maybe there was a time that we could, but that time has passed. I used to think Christian education was a luxury, but now I know it's a necessity. Whether it takes the form of a brick-and-mortar school, a virtual school, micro-school, or homeschooling, we need to cultivate in our children strong, smart, educated Christian leaders, grounded in their faith, brave in their convictions, and brightly reflecting God's holy light. We need to be passionate about providing Christ-hearted support and igniting an educational revolution that's rooted in the one true God and centered around our families. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. Again, I'm Jennifer Lasick, and this is Grace Ed. Grace Ed is produced by Learning Tree Christian Education Services in partnership with the International Association of Apostolic Educators. I hope you enjoyed our first episode. Give us a like, a share, and a review from whatever platform you're listening. And if you're a parent, a teacher, an administrator, and you have a compelling education story to share, please reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you. You can contact us through our website, ltces.org. That's ltces.org. I look forward to connecting again soon because, as the family of Christ, we're all in this together.